Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural, and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
That should be fine. But thanks for coming on tonight, folks. Thanks to Simon Edwards and the Microsoft team who supported Matt Guy's visit to Australia and made it possible for the Sydney Institute to put him on. He's in a very busy program, but thanks to Microsoft, he's at the Sydney Institute. So I'll introduce our speaker very briefly. Matt Bisey, American journalist, a United States journalist and national political writer for the New York Times magazine. He's the author of The Argument, Billionaires, Bloggers, and the Battle to Remake Democratic Politics. Now, Janet Grundy, who sells books at the Sydney Institute, is happy to order in some copies of the new edition, which will be the paperback edition, which will be in Australia in early August. It's the same book with a new afterword and a new cover. So if anyone wants to get the book, talk to Janet Crutley, who is there. And she'll be at the table, and we can put an order in for you. But the paperback's not in Australia yet. So many thanks to Matt Bide for coming along tonight to talk on the topic. I can't remember. Do you remember?
The title, I don't...
Here we are.
No,
that's why we got a bookseller here. The title is The Web and the Next US President, Political Movements in the Internet Age. Many thanks, Matt Fine.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Jared. So I appreciate the introduction. I spoke to someone. I was delayed in the airport the other night in Los Angeles, and I said I was sitting with a woman who was going back home to Australia. She said, "Well, what are you doing when you're there?" And I started going through. I had the papers, and I said, "The Sydney Institute." She said, "Oh, that's very impressive." So here you go. Hi, Prabha. I appreciate you having me here. I want to thank also the folks at Microsoft for making this possible. They've been terrific, and it's a great several days I get to spend here talking to audiences like yourself. I want you to know that I did my part for your local economy this afternoon. Just before I came here, I went walking and I went down to the rocks and I bought myself and my wife a couple of dry Zippon jackets because the man assured me that every Australian owns one. I think that's true, and because I see so many people wearing them. And I got a big, gigantic boxing kangaroo from my son. So if any of you were under the impression, had the notion that perhaps I would go back to the United States and change the stereotype about Australians, you come to the wrong place. We're here not to talk about Australian jackets. Let's talk about American politics. And I have to tell you, it's been a strange year in the United States this past 12 months or so of this campaign. Talking to people here in Sydney in the last day or so, I understand a lot of people here have already seen something like the Obama Girl video on YouTube. I don't know how many of you are familiar with this. It's a sort of risque music video. Good? Better? Can you still hear me? It's a sort of risque music video with a lot of dancing and lyrics such as healthcare reform, it keeps me warm, and you can Barack me tonight. I never thought I'd see the day when I didn't want my son or daughter to see a political video until they were older. It's been hugely influential. It's been viewed at last count by about 9 million people on YouTube. There is no political ad in this cycle that has been viewed by anything close to 9 million people. In addition to that, this is the year of the ad when a guy sat in his basement and basically created an ad that parodied 1984 Apple ad casting Hillary Clinton as Big Brother from the Orwell novel. A viral ad that went into inboxes of just about everybody who was interested in Democratic politics in the United States, I'm sure was more influential and seen by more people again than any broadcast ad. And this is the year where in a single month, this past January, Barack Obama raised $31 million online alone. Now, you know, some of you may have $31 million hanging around, but I don't know how you put that together in small dollar donations. And to put that in some perspective, Howard Dean, who is the godfather of internet fundraising in American politics, in his entire campaign in 2004 raised $25 million online. Hillary Clinton raised something like $8 million online in 24, 48 hours after Super Tuesday. My point is that it is no longer possible in America to talk about internet politics and American politics. They are the same thing. They can't really be divided. And what people say, as a matter of routine as well, the internet has changed politics in a dramatic way. This is actually not true, strictly speaking. The internet has changed everything in American life, as it has changed things in life here. And politics, as usual, is just about the last American institution to catch up. Americans used to go down to the local bank and see about mortgage rates or car loans. Now they go online and they compare them instantly and they make their own decisions and they structure their own loans. They build their own car online. They build their own computer online. They use E-Trade rather than give their money to a broker. They date online. Nobody goes to bars anymore. They go to Match.com. My son is 3 years old, has his own laptop. It's a Thomas the Tank Engine. You pop it open and play the Thomas the Tank. He likes to imitate me. Pops it open and bends it around. Puts his headphones on like it's a phone. He plays games, Curious George games, on the computer. I remember my father talking to me when I was young about when television came to his neighborhood in Bridgeport, Connecticut. Some of you may know, just outside of New York, in the 1950s, and how there was one in the neighborhood and everybody was amazed by it. And about, you know, of course, you know, 10 years after that or so, you had the first real television election in the United States, and television would dominate American politics for the next 50 years. We are seeing a similar transformation now, except I would argue that it's more profound and more lasting, because unlike television, the internet is a two-way medium. It brings people into a conversation. It doesn't simply enable you to talk at them in some new way. It revolutionizes the nature of that communication. And I believe its duration will be significantly longer. I mean, 50 years of television was a lot to endure, but as the dominant political tool. But it's not actually that long a time period. The internet, I think, will probably have a longer run. It will change. It will become video, and its format will change. But communication of people online electronically will last a very long time. And that's the change I want to talk about a little bit tonight, particularly in the Democratic Party, because Republican politics has been a little slower to catch up, and there are reasons for this. You can get an argument about what they are. I think partly it has to do with the Republican constituency in the United States. Conservatives tend to be more rural and maybe less online, older, maybe less online. There are some vibrant conservative blogs. I think more than that, it has to do with the function of being in power versus out of power. I think it is always the group out of power who utilizes and exploits new technologies. People in power feel pretty good about where they're at, and they don't have a whole lot to complain about. And until recently in the United States, as you know, Republicans were doing pretty well in power. There is this online progressive movement that is ascendant in Democratic politics and has amassed a tremendous amount of power in a very, very short time. I'll talk a little bit about this movement. It has a very distinct ethos. Its notion is that the Democratic Party sold out its principles during Bill Clinton's era of the 1990s, that the party failed to stand up to conservatives while they took over the country and took policy international and domestic in the wrong direction, that we need the country needs a more partisan Democratic Party, not a less partisan party, a more confrontational party, a party that will stand up to conservatives and make its case more strongly, and that it has been hindered or outright damaged by a lazy and unindustrious media that has bent over backward to help the conservative cause. The elements of this movement include people you've probably heard of, bloggers for starters. How many of you people here visited the American progressive blogs, Daily Kos, Open Lab, Huffington Post? Yeah, a bunch of people. They are extremely important. Daily Coast now has upwards of 500,000 viewers on any given day. To put that in perspective, it is more than all but a handful of American newspapers, and more than the entire progressive media, that is, you know, people like The Nation, Mother Jones. Put them all together, they would not even come close to equaling that number on any given day. It is a bulletin board, basically, for American liberalism, and a discussion forum and a debate forum. There are a group of, I would say, it's over 100 millionaires and billionaires and many, many more on the periphery who have banded together, who have communicated online and banded together around PowerPoint presentations. My Microsoft friends will be very happy to hear that. And they have started something called the Democracy Alliance, which I've written about, which is a pretty super secret group. They've put in upwards of $100 million in the last 3 years into building what they call a progressive infrastructure in the United States, which is essentially funding new and existing groups. And then you have groups like MoveOn.org, and I understand you have an analog to that here, GetUp, right? MoveOn, how many people here? Is anybody here GetUp members? Australians don't like to talk about their politics, right? But there's a whole bunch of them. In America, you know, if you ask, who's a MoveOn member? Ah, we are, even if they weren't. MoveOn has now about 3 million members. It's raising about $25 to $30 million a year, and it raises a lot of this money through house parties and, I'm not kidding you, bake sales. They raised over $1 million for Texas legislators who were launching a protest against redistricting by selling brownies around the country, by telling their members to go out and sell brownies. I'm not kidding. This is unbelievable stuff. And MoveOn is a fascinating case study, because what MoveOn is in many parts of the country where the Democratic Party over the last 20 or 30 years basically pulled up stakes and left, basically had no way to compete and decided it was going to just leave these rural states that they considered to be too uneducated or too racist to actually accept the Democratic argument. And they basically stopped competing in a lot of these states. And everywhere they left behind a core of diehard liberal, what we call liberal, and it's different meaning here, but Democratic voters, who had nowhere to go, who had no local party organizations, who had no way to get active. And everywhere that the Democratic Party left, from the rubble of that party, sprouted the weeds of MoveOn.org. And it's not just kids, it's a lot of older people. There's as many senior citizens as there are college-age students in MoveOn. And they are people who felt abandoned and weren't disconnected. And then came the internet, and then came MoveOn, which, by the way, was founded by a billionaire who invented those flying toasters on your screen. Again, my friends from Microsoft, very happy. And the West boy who founded these toaster ovens got very, very, very wealthy off of them and founded MoveOn. And they are a significant force. Now, everywhere you go in this movement, there are stories of ordinary people getting involved in politics in a truly extraordinary new way. And it's actually fascinating. I'm just going to tell you one quick story, which is one of my favorites, about a guy named Chuck. Chuck held a house party for MoveOn in Northern Virginia, near Washington, D.C., in 2005, not long after the election. And the guys from MoveOn said, hey, why don't you come down and come to this party so I can. Chuck lives in this very big house, nice house. He runs an advertising agency. It's actually not an advertising agency, it's a production company for advertisements. And I started to talk to Chuck. He's in his mid-40s or so. And I said, well, you must, you know, how long have you been a MoveOn member? And, you know, are you excited about the Democrats? And he said, you know, I'm not a Democrat. He said, but I've never voted in a presidential election in the United States. I said, why are these people here? There's like 60 people at his house. I said, why did you invite them here? And he said, because I live across the street from that creep. And now, he actually didn't use the word creep, but I'm going to be respectful of my audience. And I said, I don't know. I don't see anyone. You know, I don't know what you're talking about. And here's the basic story. Chuck lived across the street from a guy named Brett Bozell, which probably no one in this room has ever heard of. Brett Bozell was an icon of the conservative movement back in the 60s and 70s. He's the son-in-law of William F. Buckley, the godfather of the conservative movement. And he started media watchdog groups. His whole thing was that the media was a bunch of communists and whatnot. They had to be held accountable for their liberal views, which, by the way, they kind of were. And Chuck had gone to Brett Bozell's house, and he'd seen him in the neighborhood and said hello. But then he did a Google search, and he found out who Brett Bozell was, and it
just irritated him because he hates Bush and he hates the Republicans. And he got so angry he couldn't sleep at night. He's furious. And he passed the guy on the street, and the guy's walking his dog, and Trump just couldn't look at him, couldn't look at the dog. He said to his wife, "I'm going to go. I just want to go pee in his pool." And his wife said, "That's not constructive. You shouldn't do that." He went online and saw Move On, and they were angry too. And he joined Move On, and Move On said, "Would you like to hold a house party?" And Chuck said, "Sure. I got a nice house and a swimming pool." And before you know it, a couple weeks later, 65 people are at his house signing petitions about Supreme Court nominations. And he's engaged. He's not just engaged for the first time in politics. He's actually he's a leader. He's an activist in the community. He's actually hosting that get-together. That's an amazing thing in American politics. And I make fun a little bit, but I don't think it's a small thing what people like Trump are doing. By the way, I got a letter not long ago from Brent Bozell. I'm very fancy letterhead. He said, "You keep telling the story, and I want you to know I was really nice to that guy. He was at my house and he ate my food, and I don't know what he's telling you, but we get along just fine." Okay, Brad. And he closed his letter by saying, "There, and I made it through a whole letter without calling you a communist." Touche. We've seen the influence of this movement during this 2008 primary season, I think, in ways that I think have frankly been under-discussed and undercovered. After all, the entire ethos of this progressive movement is that Clintonism was the ruin of the party, that the 1990s hollowed out the core convictions of the Democratic Party and made it a corporatist, compromising, appeasing party. That's a word that gets used very often, and it's not an accident. And Hillary Clinton's people prior to the campaign kept telling me, no, this is just a small group of really loud people. They don't not care to listen. Look how popular Bill Clinton is in the Democratic Party. Look how popular Hillary Clinton is. When we do these polls and 80% of the people say they love the Clintons, believe me, she's fine. Well, it turned out that that argument had actually permeated the grassroots of the Democratic Party quite extensively. And while it was okay that if you ask people if they liked the Clintons, they said, "Yeah, the Clintons won. We like to win." The truth of the matter is, if you asked them what they thought of Clintonism, what they thought of the governing philosophy of the 1990s, you would have gotten a very different response. And it wasn't shocking to me that Hillary Clinton found herself meeting deep resistance in the grassroots of the Democratic Party. In fact, you may recall, if you follow American politics closely, and I know a lot of you do, there were a couple weeks where Barack Obama went on what turned out to be a very faithful role, and he won about 10 rural contests in a row without losing one. And the common thinking in America is that this is a failure of organization, and that if Hillary Clinton had gone into these states and organized and spent money, she wouldn't have been derailed. I actually think the truth is more complicated. And those were the states where Move On is strong. Those are the states where the only Democrats left are the diehard. They're the liberal of the liberal. They're the most anti-war Democrats in the country in these rural conservative states. I don't think they were going to vote for Hillary Clinton no matter how much money she put in, because this is how deeply that argument has permeated the Democratic Party. Now, Barack Obama was the beneficiary of this anti-Clinton sentiment, and I think he became the vehicle against her. And after everybody else was out of the race, MoveOn.org came in and endorsed him, and so did some of the more progressive unions who are part of this movement. The fact is, and it's important going forward to understand this, Obama defined his campaign in direct opposition to that progressive movement. That the whole ethos of that movement is partisanship, and Obama's entire argument is that there's too much partisanship in politics, that there's too much reactionary, knee-jerk opposition, that it's too much about protecting your dogmas from years past, that the same arguments have been going on for 20 or 30 years, and it's time to transcend them and find common ground. And this has infuriated progressives who refuse to support Obama early on in the campaign. In fact, Paul Krugman, who writes for our op-ed page and who's a real voice of this movement, an icon of this movement, has repeatedly attacked Obama from the beginning of the race for using what he calls Republican talking points. And you'll recall that, because he admits that Social Security might be a problem, and he admits that Republicans might have a point about certain things, and you'll recall, perhaps, if you follow this, that one of the interesting moments of this primary season, Obama got into real trouble because he said that he thought Ronald Reagan had been a transformational president in a way that Bill Clinton had not. And this caused a huge stir among Democrats on the blogs and online, because this is absolute treason to admit that Ronald Reagan had anything good going for him at all.
And also, Obama had said something else that irritated a lot of progressives. He had the gall to say that he thought President Bush was not a bad person, per se, although he disagreed with everything the president did. This was too positive for a lot of folks in the progressive movement. Obama is, in fact, the only candidate, the only Democrat, I should say, the only Democratic official, leading official, to have actually directly challenged the blogs. And he did this in 2005. He got very irritated at some of the attacks on his colleagues who were not voting the way on the Supreme Court nominations that the bloggers wanted them to. And Obama went home and did something his staff said he should never have done. He went home and he went on his personal computer and he started banging out an argument that he then posted on Daily Coast, or had someone post on Daily Coast because he didn't know how to do it. And it was called Tone, Truth, and Consequences. And I'll read you a quote I took down from that because I think it's very important. And it's going to be important going forward because he has to balance this constituency. He said, "I firmly believe that whenever we exaggerate or demonize or oversimplify or overstate our case, we lose. Whenever we dumb down politics, the political debate, we lose. I would argue that the most powerful voices of change in the country, from Lincoln to King, have been those who could speak with the utmost conviction about the great issues of the day without ever belittling those who opposed them and without denying the limits of their own perspective." Now, I think that's a pretty brilliant summation, actually. And it's easy to sympathize with Obama here because there is a lot that's deeply inspiring about this new brand of online politics. The way it engages thousands of people whose voices had not previously been heard. The way it gives people a sense that politics is bottom-up and not top-down. But there's also some things that are not so inspiring about it. And I think they're problematic. One is, as I often put it to people, and it's a point I'm very adamant about, is I fear that we're leaving the age of persuasion and entering the age of confirmation. And what I mean by that is that people used to pick up a story you would write or see a report. They might like the subject, they might not like the subject, they might agree with the initial premise, but they would read it through and they would weigh it against other things and they might argue with you, but they would actually process what they were reading. Now it seems that in this culture, people read about two paragraphs, and if you don't immediately confirm for them what they already believed about the world, they throw it aside because there's about 2,000 websites they can go to right now that will tell them that everything they believed is already is true. And this, I think, is really problematic because people don't have to leave their intellectual comfort zone. They don't want to be challenged. And the real tragedy here, I think, is that there are commentators and columnists in my business, and I won't name names even here, who have heard the sound of the applause and have decided that it's easier and more fulfilling and, yes, even more profitable at times to tell people what they want to hear over and over again than it is to try and challenge them and risk their wrath. And they write the same column or say the same thing over and over and over because it makes people feel good. There's a genre of books I've called comfort books for liberals because it simply tells them why voters just aren't very smart. And I consider this an abdication of our responsibility. I really do, because our responsibility is to challenge preconceptions, our own preconceptions and your preconceptions. And when we don't do that, we fail. It doesn't always make you popular, but if you want to be popular, you should drive a nice cream truck or do something else. Give away toys. The other thing I find less than inspiring, and this is a critical point of my book, of course, is that this is an almost entirely tactical movement. Virtually all of the conversation, 90% of the conversation, is about how you get power, how you frame things, what words you use, what the polling says, how you approach issues, standing up for your convictions, etc., etc. There's almost no discussion about what you do with power once you get it, and about what direction you take the country in. There's no argument for the 21st century, and this is really critical. Now, I want to define this a little bit because this means different things to different people, and people use different terminologies. Here's what I'm not saying. I'm not suggesting the Democrats don't know what they stand for, because I think the principles that animate Democratic politics have more or less been the same since Franklin Roosevelt, and will probably be relevant for another 100 years. Those principles of opportunity and equality and broad prosperity etc. And I don't think it's the Democrats don't have ideas, because there's all kinds of policy ideas sitting on the shelves all over Washington, and you've heard them all a million times, and I've heard them more. What an argument is, I think, is that you have to make sense of the moment for people. That is, it's not enough to tell people just what's wrong. We're in a war we shouldn't be in, we don't have health care, we're losing jobs. People get that. They get up in the morning and they get that. They want to understand why. They want to understand what are the forces in the world that bring this moment to them. How does it make sense? And then once you can make sense of it, how do you propose to change or adapt government to meet the challenge? Because the history of American politics is not the history of people identifying new challenges and then trotting out the same old government to fix it. The great rich tradition, the amazing thing about American politics and history is people having the courage and the flexibility and the imagination to change government in ways that make it relevant again. That's the beauty of the system. And there has been, right to this point, no cogent argument about how government changes. There's a lot of talk in the progressive movement about how you put government back to where it was before the conservatives got there. But I don't think it's persuasive to most Americans, and frankly not to me, that this notion that the government of 30 years ago or 20 years ago is sufficient for the problems that exist today. America is facing deep and intractable new problems. We have serious global economic challenges and a decline of the engine that drove American prosperity, the manufacturing engine. We have obviously new national security challenges, not just for our own safety, but given our role in the world for the larger security of the West. And these challenges are in some ways more difficult than any we've ever faced as a country, I think, only because at every other point in American history where we faced significant policy challenges, we did so as an expanding economic power with an expanding middle class, so that more and more things were possible. There was more and more money to spend. That's not the case now. And we did so knowing that we controlled internally the factors that would enable us to find a solution. We were not vulnerable to what was happening in the rest of the world, neither economically or militarily, and that's not true anymore. Now we're affected by everything that goes on in China and India and South America and every oil-producing country and everything else. And I think the question is how you move beyond old dogmas and how you figure out what's next for American politics. Now, I do think these ideologies will change. I'm optimistic that this argument, the arguments we've been having in American politics for these decades, will change. And I think the online technology has a lot to do with it. Because I think as a generation that grew up with the internet continues to get more engaged in politics and more influential, the mindset they bring with them is going to affect politics. There's not necessarily an ideology, a single ideology in the internet, but there is a sensibility, there's a philosophy that comes from living your life online. People online expect a range of choices, customization, and flexibility. They don't like to be told how everything needs to be. They like to make choices about their lives and have some control over their outcomes. They expect institutions to listen and be responsive. They expect flatter hierarchies. They expect transparency. They want information. They don't want secrecy. They want everything to be done openly. And they believe in a sense of community. It's when you're online, you might be in Omaha, but you might be talking to someone in Los Angeles or Atlanta or Orlando, Florida, or Detroit, Michigan. The boundaries, the geographic and regional boundaries, are no longer as important when you're a MoveOn member or a blogger and you're talking to people all over the country. And if you could customize your mortgage or your car or build your computer online, why would you settle for one-size-fits-all inflexible government programs of the industrial age? If you can live in New York and be part of a community of like-minded people that includes people in Austin and Omaha, or vice versa, if you're in a rural part of the country and you're talking to people in the cities, how can you settle for solutions that leave other people behind? Or premises that rest on the fact that everybody else is trying to destroy you or doesn't respect your values? I think the next generation is going to be open to new solutions. And in that sense, Obama may be right that, in fact, we can transcend the old arguments of the past, that we can explore ways to change it. But it's important to remember, too, I think, and this is my final point to you, and I'll have gone on too long already, that The internet is a vehicle. It's not an end in itself. It's only a technology. Immediacy and engagement are not ends in themselves, right? They are means to an end. They're opportunities, and it's how you use those opportunities that's important. Television made John Kennedy possible and Ronald Reagan possible in America because they were fantastic communicators. But television didn't send a man to the moon, didn't make it necessary that that would happen. Television didn't necessarily mean that the Cold War would end. Television didn't invent morning in America or the new frontier. That was the power of the argument. That was the message that carried the day. And just as Franklin Roosevelt's fireside chats weren't about the technology of the radio, that some magical technology that rallied a country closely enough to fight World War II and overcome the Great Depression, it was the depth of Roosevelt's conviction and his message and his hopefulness that came across to people who were gathered around that radio. It was a way to hear the argument. It was not the argument. And no technology will stand in for an argument. In the internet age, we're going to need the creativity and the courage of leaders to realize the potential of that technology. And we're going to need them to lead people online and not simply follow the impulses of Americans that they're supposed to be, in fact, bringing toward the future. So, thank you for bearing with me. Thank you for your interest in the book. I'm glad to answer any questions you have. I appreciate it.
There are a couple of seats up the front or anyone standing down the back. As I said earlier, Janet Grundy from Books Etc. will take orders for the new, up-to-date, printed edition of The Argument Inside the Battle to remake Democratic Politics. So we come to questions and discussion. I'll return your hardback version. We'll finish no later than 7 o'clock.
Matt, could I ask, in this new internet phenomenon, can you explain why Barack Obama has now decided he will have no more than one debate with John McCain in the old style? Is this his idea of transforming old politics, or is he in fact a little uncertain that he can't manage old politics?
Yeah. Now I'll get you to come back here and just talk again.
Sure. I'm going to be honest with you. I've been engaged in some other things, but I'm not aware that that's the hard and fast one. I know there's been a lot of negotiation going on. You may be right. I may have missed something in the last week. But my understanding was there was a larger debate going on about what kinds of debate. McCain and Obama agreed in principle that they would do something that removed the media as a filter. They don't want the media to moderate. They want to do some kind of new, different kind of debate. But McCain wants it to be only town hall meetings. And Obama's kind of balking at that for whatever reason. They want to look at some other formats. In addition, they'll do, I'm fairly certain, again, unless I missed something, that they'll do the Presidential Debate Commissions. We have in the United States this thing called the Presidential Debate Commission. Don't even get me started about it, because I think it's a travesty, and I can't stand it. Because I don't think the media should be dictated to by an organization run by two parties, frankly. But that Presidential Debate Commission decides the format and times of debates. And I'm not aware of any decision to opt out of those debates. No candidates will generally do anything outside of that debate. So any town hall meetings or other forums they organize outside of those debates will actually be an improvement on will actually be extra debates that we've had in the past. But look, I think, you know, to your larger point, there's going to be a lot of wrangling over this. And these guys, unfortunately, they really don't like each other very much, I don't think. But these are two guys who staked their careers on reform. And in many ways, they do represent a pretty exciting choice for Americans. I mean, you know, they both challenged the status quo of their party. Neither is the scion of some great political family or involved in New England prep schools or whatever else that we've seen in the last couple of elections. You know, neither is an incumbent. Obviously, they're both best-selling authors, which is quite extraordinary. They've both written fabulous books, and you know, there's a great well of support for both of them among independents, I think, or at least the potential for that. And I think they both want to do politics differently, and I think there's a real potential for a really ennobling debate this fall. I don't know if we're going to have it. We're not off to a very good start on that count. It's been sort of back and forth and pretty nasty for the last couple of weeks as they both try to transition out of the primary and into, you know, this general election period and try to keep their parties happy in addition to, you know, creating their own storylines. But I think this is going to, my hope is, and my expectation is that this is going to end up being a very good campaign and a very good choice for voters. If, you know, I think if people complain about their choices as the lesser of evils this time, there's nothing more we can do for them.
You were saying that some of the online, the move-on types regard Clintonism as the ruin of the Democratic Party. But as you know, she lost, but she got high 40% of, sure. of the vote, and she won some pretty important primaries and some swing states. So there is still a lot of, I mean, obviously not a lot of Democratic voters don't regard the Clintons as the ruin.
No. I mean, we are talking about this online progressive movement, and I think, you know, there was enough of that resistance and sentiment to cost her the nomination or to make it extraordinarily difficult, to make the math for her very difficult in many states. But obviously she also has great strength. Clintons have very deep support and strength in the Democratic Party and other quarters of the Democratic Party, particularly among people who are not part of this self-identified progressive movement. People who are the traditional labor base of the party, older activists. You know, she did very well with older voters. She did very well with workers and labor types. She did very, very well with women across the board. You know, it's not a particularly diverse group online. And actually, you know, there's a couple things that contributed. You know, I do think there is this deep resistance to Clintonism in the party that made it very hard for her to maneuver. But even then, had her opponent been almost anyone else, and had she been able to win even a sizable chunk of the African-American vote, even a sizable minority of that vote, she still would likely have been the nominee. The thing that destroyed, you know, the Clinton math in this primary season was the fact that 90% of the African-American vote basically fell into his column after Iowa. And the Clintons had enjoyed tremendous support in that community up to that point, and it made it very, very difficult for them to figure out a way to cobble the math together. But had it not been, I think, for that progressive resistance to this return to the 90s, to Clintonism, you know, I think she would have turned. I think she would have been much, much harder to beat.
Can we go down the back, Alison?
Mr. Bay, I read Tom Paine every day, which is really good. And there, I think it was...
That's one of the first.
Yes. There, I think it was, I saw a story the other day in which this woman was saying any modern job in the United States that you went to apply for and you couldn't use the internet, you would be shown the door immediately. Why not the President of the United States? And John McCain revealed the other day when he was talking about Google, but he had not the funniest idea what it was. Do you
want to
comment on that?
I think not knowing what Google is, I didn't see that, not knowing what Google is problematic.
You mean the allegation is problematic?
He's got the same
Google.
The Google. The Google. George W. Bush had. George W. Bush at one time talked about the internets. the internets were very good. I think that's a fair point. I think that you kind of hit at the heart of Obama's appeal here. I mean, because there are plenty of politicians at the highest ranks of American politics who can't or don't use the internet. By the way, Howard Dean is one of them. I think he's come a long way. But because I know he likes now to shop for plane tickets online. And I did once catch him having a bat in the game with somebody in China or something. But in general, when he first became sort of this vehicle for the online democratic movement, you know, he didn't have any notion at all of how to use email or the internet or any of that. He is Bill Clinton, by the way. He may now, but he didn't know how to use email. But I do think this is going to be, you know, whether or not that's a qualification, whether or not you can certainly make an argument whether or not a president should know how to do that, but I don't think many presidents have time to, you know, sit around emailing. But you know, this is going to be at the heart of Obama's argument for the fall, which is, you know, you're from another era, right? Which is, this is what we need. We need an internet president. We need somebody who gets what's going on. We need somebody who knows the language, who can identify with the way people are living their lives. This is going to be his strongest case, in a sense, that we've never had an age difference this pronounced in a presidential election in America. I guess McCain will be, he's 71, he would be 72 when he took office. Obama's, what, 46, 45? So, I mean, 46. So that it's quite a difference, and they will definitely try to exploit that. On the other side, you know, McCain will say, what have you done? I mean, by any experience level, the Obama people hate it when I say this. Look, I think the guy's a singular political talent, perhaps the talent of his generation. But by any historical standard, he does not have the objective qualification to be president. And by the way, I think this is part of the, you know, I think this is part of the internet age too, because with the internet has come, this is a really important point, that with the internet has come the devaluing of expertise, of formal expertise. I mean, the web creates a culture. I don't know if you see it here, I presume, I would guess that you do, where people look and say, well, why is that guy on TV a pundit? I can be a pundit. Why is he talking about politics? He doesn't sound like he knows what he's talking about. I'll go online and I'll do it. And now you're a political blogger, right? There are sports blogs all over America, you know, where it's, if I were the general manager of that team, what an idiot. You know, you should do this, you should do this. Guys never know. You know what's wrong with you know, Alex Rodriguez is swinging? You know, I don't know if any of you follow baseball. Alex Rodriguez is one of the greatest baseball players of all time, and this is some guy who's, you know, hasn't played since junior high school. You know, and it's this itch in his hands. You know, that is, there's this feeling people have empowered by the internet that somehow expertise don't mean much anymore, that everybody is their own expert. That's sort of that is the ethos of the web. And I don't think 10 years ago or 15 years ago that a guy like Obama could be the nominee of his party. I think there's a new feeling that formal qualifications and expertise simply are not the prerequisite in American life that they used to be.
There's a question over here. Yeah.
I'm taking too long to answer. There's too many questions, so I'm going to give a haiku answer.
The big issues in Australia, as you've probably picked up since you've been here, are around the rising price of fuel and our emissions trading scheme.
I came halfway around the world with the exact same conversation.
And of course there's food riots around the world in part due to the rising cost of fossil fuels. I'm not seeing very much in the media that I'm reading about that in the American election context, and I think a lot of people around the world are interested to know what either candidate might be doing once they're in power in relation to these very big global issues.
Well, it's a huge issue in the campaign right now and in the last couple of weeks, because I know when I say this you all laugh at me because you have a very different situation. I mean, it cost me $80 to fill up my car last week. That's unheard of in America. Even, you know, I drive this big gas guzzling car. I mean, I realize that for all of you that's not so crazy, but in America it's causing great pains and fits. My car is basically valueless now. And it's a shame because I just bought it. And what's interesting about this debate, there is a debate, Graham. McCain has said in the last couple of weeks, first McCain said he wanted to give a moratorium on the gas tax for the summer to give families on vacation a break, which amounts to like pennies and absolutely means absolutely nothing. Everybody laughed at him. Then, and Hillary Clinton said, me too, by the way. Then Obama said, are you people crazy? Then McCain said in last week that he would end the moratorium on offshore drilling so that America could get more oil off its own shore. There's obviously there's an absolutely irreconcilable contradiction here, which we have not talked about very much in America, which is, on one hand, John McCain is one of the true, you have to give him credit here, he's one of the true voices for climate, for sounding the alarm on climate change in his party. He was on this early. Democrats will argue that his votes haven't reflected it, but whatever. He's been a strong proponent for dealing with it. And as he said on the campaign trail, look, I heard him say this to core Republicans, and this takes no small amount of courage. Look, if I'm wrong, I want to put all this money into renewable fuels. If I'm right, then I save the planet for our children. If I'm wrong, all I do is create a new job industry for everybody. So, you know, I think this is a chance we have to take. At the same time, you know, Democrats sound very much the same theme. At the same time, everybody wants cheaper gas. Democrats ran on it in 2006. McCain's running on it right now. This is awful. Working families need a break. They can't afford gas for their cars. We're all reliant on our cars. So which is it exactly? Are we creating a new energy environment, or are we giving people cheap gas to fill up SUVs? This contradiction just continues in American politics because it's a box, right? Everybody knows there needs to be some new change in energy policy and some new emphasis on environmentalism. At the same time, gas is just a visceral issue, and if you promise people cheaper gas, you figure you're going to get away with it. I do think Americans are coming to the point, if they've not already, that they are open to the idea that this is going to take some sacrifice and there's going to be some transitional cost, but we need a new direction. they are, as on so many issues, awaiting an intellectually honest form of leadership. And hopefully we get it this fall or after the election.
There's a question there. Here. We've got a quick question, yes, too.
Yep. You mentioned the internet as a tool and not taking the place of argument. To what extent do you think it's possible for the internet to take on the role of politicians in their representative capacity? So, for example, we've had referendums in the past to get...
Yeah.
Could you comment on that?
Well, I can comment on it broadly. I mean, this is how MoveOn works. MoveOn is a ruthlessly efficient barometer of its members. There's no leadership in MoveOn. It's just kind of a mob rule. Everybody votes on everything. There is a conflict here. There's an Athenian democratic sensibility to the web, right? It makes it possible for just everybody to weigh in, even if it's a self-selecting audience, right? On every issue. If we can know how everybody feels about everything all the time, what do we need leaders for? I think that's what you're saying, right? And of course, the United States isn't built that way. The United States is built as a republic of states, which are semi-autonomous and which traditionally have enjoyed a tremendous amount of local control, I think, to the benefit of citizens. In some cases, notable exceptions being like racial segregation. So there's this question of, there's this conflict here, and I think you see it played out on issues like the Electoral College, where there's been a great deal of rebellion in the last several years after the election of 2000. Why do we have this thing called the Electoral College? I don't know how familiar you all are with it, but it's this really weird, arcane way that we elect our president. And I think there's a danger here. I mean, again, I think this cries out for leadership, but I don't think we want to go toward an Athenian democracy. I think the reason our democracy has survived and thrived for the last couple hundred years and has a very good prognosis is because it's not a Greek kind of democracy. It actually, it's an ingenious system that actually, as yours is, that actually keeps this kind of federalist republic idea very much at the core of its existence and allows people to be interactive and heard and responded to without sort of breaking down the walls and allowing the mob to run over the palace. And I think the web creates new challenges to that. I think it does naturally make people wonder why it is that they can't just have referenda on everything. But I'm pretty confident the system will endure. I certainly hope so. I'm sure there are people who hope the opposite. We should all just go home in Washington. People will just weigh in every day. But to me, that's like a bad science fiction novel.
Question here.
Yes, how left are the people, the progressives you're talking about, and how would Obama reconcile them with the sort of working class high school graduates who voted for Hillary Clinton? I mean, does he have to reconcile those two groups?
It's a good question, and I don't think anyone knows the answer for sure. It's not really a question of left or center anymore in the Democratic Party. There's no ideological difference. There's not a dime's worth of ideological difference between Clinton and Obama. The people who call themselves centrists, the people who call themselves liberals, all vote pretty much the same. There's very few dividing points there. It's really about tone and tactics. It's really about how confrontational you are. Bipartisanship is something Southern Democrats, more conservative Democrats traditionally, really believe in. Bipartisanship is something that the progressive movement thinks is a really bad word. Right? So it's a question of how the party should conduct itself in pursuit of its goals more than the goals, which tended to be a little bit dated but not a particular source of disagreement. For this reason, I don't think it's going to be hard to reconcile the Clinton-Obama thing because there's just not an ideological divide. This is not the old days of the Democratic Party, pro-war, anti-war. This is not a fight for the soul of the party. This is a fight between two very charismatic personalities with a great, with loyal following. He does, though, have a problem like that. So I don't think there's a lot of core Clinton voters who are necessarily going to go to him. But her numbers among women, particularly, are some concern to him, I think, because there are segments of either Democratic leaning voters or independents who are frustrated with the president who will give McCain a hearing. Try as they will every day, and the Democrats will try every day to make McCain, Bush the sequel. I don't think people are really going to buy that in the end. He's just not. He's got a hard-earned reputation for being his own guy. And despite what he had to do to get the Republican nomination, which was quite unseemly at times, I think people, can be reminded. I think he can successfully remind people of his, of his independence. And so, I think there are constituencies that might have voted for her where Obama is vulnerable, but I also think he brings a lot of voters into play that she would not have because she is seen as a polarizing figure. So at the end of the day, you know, it's impossible to say, you know, who would have been a better candidate, but I think in the Democratic Party he's safe. I think Democrats are united enough that I don't think they'll deserve. Now, there were polls, you know, at the time that said, at the time of these primaries, 40% of people who voted in, you know, Indiana or whatever for Clinton said they'll never vote for Obama, or vote for John McCain or whatever it was. You know, people asked me about this. I said, you know what? If you'd asked me when my son threw his spaghetti last on the floor whether I wanted another child, I would probably have said no. But I have another child, and I'm very happy about it. And that's because, you know, in the heat of a moment, people will say a lot of things. But I don't think come November there are a lot of core Democrats who are going to be comfortable voting Republican.
Okay, so there's a question down there. Yeah, down the back. Yep.
What do you think of the view that the election is merely for Obama to win or lose, and McCain is not overly relevant to how the presidency will be decided? Is it keen to win or lose?
There's a grain of truth in that. I don't think it's exactly right. I mean, it is true that it is, you know, certainly the conditions are right for Obama. Frankly, they were right for John Kerry in 2004, but let's just put that aside. The conditions are definitely, you know, should favor Obama, but, you know, McCain is quite relevant in this because how convincingly he can make the case to independents that he is the guy they thought he was, that he is a reasonable independent figure, that he is post-partisan, that, you know, to the extent that he can steal Obama's argument of post-partisanship and reform. This campaign is going to be about reform, and John McCain is a credible reformer. To the extent he makes that argument well and doesn't feel out of touch, he doesn't feel like a relic from another era, he has a real chance to win. I mean, he's already done some very smart things. He's come out and said he would institute a question time with Congress, like you all have here. He's come out and said he'll do weekly news conferences, which in America is like, you know, unheard of at this point. I mean, nobody's done it. Bush has done probably fewer than 25 news conferences in his entire presidency in 8 years. I could be wrong about that. I don't want to say that and have somebody say he's done 150, but he's done very, very. I mean, he's gone many, many months without facing the press. And I don't think he gave a sit-down interview to the New York Times until his second term. You know, so McCain is talking about coming down every week. So, I mean, he is a credible reformer to the extent he makes that case. You know, he's definitely going to get a hearing. Obama's an interesting candidate because we don't know much about him, frankly. Nobody does. And people in the Democratic Party don't. The constituencies of the party don't know much about Obama. He just got here. I mean, to give you a sense of how historically bizarre this is, he gave the keynote address in the 2004 Democratic Convention as a state senator. He had never won a statewide election in his state of Illinois. 4 years later, he will take the stage and accept the nomination of the presidency. That's like Abraham Lincoln territory. That's like crazy, unheard of. And that has a tremendous upside because he's very, very talented. And he represents a real form of vast change and departure from the past. And also a very important social change in a country that's been tormented by race relations. There is a real feel-good quality to that candidacy. There's a real chance, I think, for America to turn a page, and people like that. But he also has this downside that's also much greater than another candidate. We don't know what he'll be like as a general election candidate. We don't know how race plays in an American election. A lot of people think a black man can't be elected. And you know, he's been mostly relying on sort of lofty rhetoric and vagueness that's not going to suffice, I don't think, for the fall. So, you know, a lot of this has to do with how good a candidate Obama proves to be, but I think McCain's skills are quite relevant as well.
Question down the back there. Hey,
just looking to the election at the end of the year, do you think there's a mood afoot in the United States for the next president to be a young, inexperienced black person?
I think it's quite possible. Look, give the man credit. First of all, let's give Obama a little bit of credit. He is a singular political talent, extremely thoughtful, impressive guy, extremely charismatic and eloquent, and he's run an outstanding campaign. For a guy who's never run anything this big, he made precious few mistakes, and he beat an icon of the Democratic Party, a much more famous and candidate who was supposed to be better funded. And he surrounded himself with an incredibly gifted team of people. So Obama's proved himself to be a pretty skilled manager, a pretty skilled guy. At a normal moment in American politics, in the last several decades, pre-internet, pre-George W. Bush, pre-Iraq? Could a guy of Obama's resume and race and background be seriously considered a likely president? No, probably not. For myriad reasons, beginning first and foremost with his resume, which is really, really thin in national politics. But we had change moments in America. I mean, many of you recall 1976. Jimmy Carter served one term as Georgia governor, and he was out of office when he ran post-Watergate. He had no business running for president. We found out later he had very little business being president. But he and a lot of first-time legislators were elected on that wave of reform. And John Kennedy in 1960, I mean, I hesitate. I squirm a little when people compare Kennedy because we forget there's something different about having been a war veteran and a war hero. And yes, Kennedy had served. He'd served in Congress and he'd served in the Senate. Not for long periods of time, but he had served. And he had commanded men in battle. And I think that, that matters in American politics. It's not quite the same thing as Obama. But, at that moment in history, he was able to win an election. It would have been hard for him to win at some other point. And of course, the example that Obama likes to use is Lincoln, which, granted, is kind of, way out there in terms of similarity, but Lincoln was a completely unprepared president who came to power at a time where that would have only been possible in his era. So, we have moments where things are possible. Do I think this is one of those moments? Yes, I absolutely think it's possible. I'm not saying it'll happen, but this is an extraordinary moment in American politics. There's a tremendous amount of unease and a tremendous amount of dissatisfaction with the past. I think we are seeing a sort of generational change, and Obama represents the vanguard of that next gen, post baby boomer generation, and I might add another moment too soon.
Final brief question over here. Yep.
As a blogger, I see something, I report it, simple as that, bound by no ethical restraints but my own. How do you think?
Sounds liberating.
How do you think that politics has changed, considering that politicians are facing both a mainstream media that's identifiable and anyone they meet being an amateur reporter?
I mean, if as a blogger you report, you see something and report it, you would be unusual in the United States, because most blogging in the United States is about seeing what I've reported and talking about it. And we are starting to see some original reporting. In fact, one of the people who's been most influential in this campaign is a woman I've never met named Mayhill Fowler, a middle-aged woman, I think she's from California, who has followed Obama around for a project called Off the Bus from Huffington Post. She's a citizen blogger and has caught some really big moments that have resonated with the campaign. And she's been a terrific reporter. Reporting is not, as you implied, reporting is not rocket science. I mean, you see something, you explain it to people. We don't need a whole lot of training for that. It's a gift, but I don't think it's necessarily it's not a physics. Thankfully. I think politicians are just starting to adapt to this. I mean, 4 years ago, the cable networks sent people out with little handheld cameras, and they kind of roamed around with these cameras, and it kind of made the candidates a little uncomfortable because they were always being filmed doing their own thing, eating lunch or whatever. Now, I think candidates just routinely expect that anything they say anywhere that's not in the privacy or room in their advisor can find its way online. Any moment can be recorded and instantly put online. I mean, they don't know who the journalist is anymore, which is kind of what you're saying, right? They don't know who's watching, who's recording, who's videoing. And by the way, neither do we as journalists. I mean, I was telling a story earlier today. I was kind of half joking, but it was true. I saw somebody blogging about sharing a cab with me, and apparently I was quite boorish and didn't want to pay the cab, which is like, why wouldn't I pay the cab? I'm not even paying for it, quite honestly. It was a good way for this person to get a lot of applause on Daily Coast or whatever. She was on Fire Dog Lake or some stupid, because she had this interaction with me, and it was, painting me that way was very, fun for everybody. But it's a changed world, and for politicians, of course, it's a whole other level. So there is more caution now. There is more concern. But hopefully that'll be balanced out by more interaction, right? I mean, I think we're going to have blogging presidents pretty soon. I know we're going to have White House bloggers. So, you take the good with the bad. It's a changed environment. Just like television was a changed environment. I think they're slowly adapting to it.
Many thanks. Take a seat.
Sure.
We could have gone all night.
it's 7 o'clock, right on time, so I'll be very brief. Thanks to Clayton to produce this fine facility this evening. Janet Grundy will take orders for the argument, which will be in Australian paperback form in August, and I'm sure any bloggers here tonight will say that we've had a highly entertaining and very informative evening, and to reuse an increasingly well-known American phrase, I think it's also fair to say that it was a fair and balanced assessment of both the Obama campaign and the McCain campaign, and I certainly learned a lot tonight, and I'm sure we all did. So many thanks for that by our speaker.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.